Welcome to my podcast, which seeks to summarise key events in relation to changes to the planning system that took place last week, and particularly on the Wednesday the 13th of May. Because it's been an important and probably key one in terms of those changes and moving the planning process forward in response to the pandemic. There was a flurry of activity with new legislation, updated planning practice guidance, a written statement from the Secretary of State, and updated guidance from both the Ministry and from the Planning Inspectorate. And I will summarise key aspects of those shortly. But putting that into context, it followed on from the Prime Minister's broadcast on Sunday, the 10th of May, in the evening of that day, heralding, as we all know, the commencement of the loosening, albeit to a modest degree, of the previous restrictions on movements and activities. I'll summarise these key matters, dealing with five topics. Firstly, applications. Secondly, planning appeals. And in relation to both those, also cover guidance on SIL payments and on Section 106 obligations and the changes proposed in respect of each of those. Thirdly, development plans. And fourthly, compulsory purchase orders. And fifthly, nationally significant infrastructure projects. So turning first to planning applications, and indeed planning legislation that was introduced and came into effect on Thursday the 14th of May, and that was the gloriously named Town and Country Planning Development Management Procedure Listed Buildings and Environmental Impact Assessment, England Coronavirus Amendment Regulations 2020. And for those who want a specific reference, that's Statutory Instrument 2020 number 505. These regulations deal on a temporary basis, expiring on the 31st of December 2020, with some of the current practical difficulties relating to publicising various applications. Those difficulties, of course, arising from restrictions on social contact and physical events. And these changes seek to ensure that the process of validation and consideration of applications is not held up. And we all know the pressure to ensure that development isn't held up. The regulations make those changes by amending the existing relevant legislation. And they relate to various applications, as I indicated, including planning permission and listed building consent applications. And they allow for the publicity of such applications by electronic means during the relevant period. And such electronic steps can include the use of social media and electronic communications, and they must be proportionate to the scale and nature of the development. There's guidance issued on the topic, and that makes it clear that when it may be difficult to provide such publication by site display, by service of notice on an adjoining owner or occupier, and in newspapers, and those difficulties arising from the effect of the coronavirus, that guidance says that then those alternative methods should be available and should be used. And you find guidance, as I say, in the PPG, the new paragraphs 35 to 52. You will obviously be able to find that fairly quickly, but if you want a quick link, you can find that in the Chambers article from last Friday, the 15th of May, under the heading of Legal COVID-19 Update. And that's part of our regular updates. Leading on from that, in terms of planning applications, to complement those legislative changes, the updated planning guidance on consultation and pre-decision matters says that under the temporary planning application, publicity requirements brought in during the pandemic, the minimum period local planning authorities must state for representations in a newspaper notice and on their website has been increased from 14 to 21 days, and indeed longer where the period includes public or bank holidays. Note, though, that there's two matters that are unchanged, and two important matters. Firstly, the period of 21 days given for the applications under the Planning Listed Building and Conservations Area Regulations 1990 remains the same, and secondly, the period of 30 days for environmental impact assessment applications also remains the same. Further, there's confirmation of two matters. One is that there will be no changes to the determination timescales for planning applications, and you'll probably seen in the planning press quite a lot of debate on that, but at present there is no intention to change that. And secondly, encouragement of local planning authorities continues to hold virtual planning meetings. And of course, such meetings are already enabled by way of Regulation 5 of the, and I'll give it shortly, the Flexibility of Local Authority Regulations 2020. And the Ministry is working with the Planning Advisory Service to provide further practical advice on the way these matters are managed. And just flag up there, very worthwhile looking at the Planning Advisory Service a website, because they do give very informative, practical and helpful advice, which is kept fairly up to date. And it's based upon learning from ongoing experience, of course, which is what we're all having to learn from in current circumstances. And just a final matter in relation to development aspects directly, and that's construction working hours. The Ministry has made it clear that planning conditions should not be a barrier to allowing developers and site operators flexibility around construction site working hours in order to, of course, to facilitate safe working. Two things to note. Firstly, where only short-term or modest increases in working hours are required, authorities are encouraged to use their discretion not to enforce against a breach of working hours conditions. But secondly, where longer term measures or other significant changes are required, applications to amend conditions should be made, which authorities should prioritise and turn around, it is advised, in 10 days. It should also be noted that requests to work for up to 9 p.m. Monday to Saturday should not be refused without very compelling reasons. And that's fairly forceful advice. It'd be interesting to see how local residents affected by works will react to that. However, I do note that it doesn't apply to Sunday, so hopefully there will still be some downtime and peacetime during the overall 7-day week. Okay, from planning applications, turning to planning appeals, and in particular, the Secretary of State's written statement, and that was given on Wednesday, and it's on virtual working and planning, and 5 points to make on that. Firstly, he emphasised the importance of virtual working, and he, making the best of things, he stated that this presents opportunities to increase participation in planning processes, which are important for local communities and will minimise the impacts of delays to planning decisions which might otherwise occur due to the requirements for social distancing. That's of interest because, of course, the great worry is that virtual working potentially does cause difficulties for participation of third parties. I mean, participation of many, but certainly of third parties, particularly if they don't have access to computers or similar devices. However, it does show practical application of my quote of the week. Now, I don't like the analogy of the current situation being similar to wartime in terms of general pressures on the population. There are some similarities, but of course, totally different circumstances. Nonetheless, a Churchillian quote is quite a useful quote in this particular context, and that is, never let a good crisis go to waste. And it seems that the Secretary of State is certainly abiding by that. Second matter to make out of his statement is he recognised, of course, that it was a matter for pins, but nonetheless the move to digital events and processes will be critical to ensure that the planning system continues to operate effectively to support economic recovery. Thirdly, the government expects events to be taken place by mid-June, other, and this really is critical, than in exceptional circumstances. And it expects the inspectorate to identify those more exceptional circumstances where a virtual event may not be appropriate, making decisions about how to proceed based on the facts of each particular case. And that really does show an interesting emphasis on the virtual methods of holding these matters. Fourthly, and linked, where exceptionally it may not be fair to proceed virtually, alternative arrangements should be taken forward speedily, where possible, taking into account the government's guidance on social distancing. And I'm involved in an inquiry due to commence on the 9th of June, where the inspector has recognised the position of both parties who are reluctant to consider this appropriate for a virtual inquiry or virtual event due to the extent of the witnesses and nature of the disputes and generally being very difficult to hold such an inquiry with so many witnesses, other than by the traditional method. And the inspector recognises that in a letter last week. He is exploring, in a diligent but nonetheless sensitive way, whether in fact the inquiry can proceed on the fixed date. And that involves investigating the safety of the venue, the technical aspects as to whether it can be webcast for the public to see. And I have to say, there's also the practical problems, because I would have to travel, is whether there's anywhere I can stay locally and maintain social distancing. Remembering I then have to return to my family and the household in which I live, where there are two vulnerable adults. So these are all sort of personal challenges facing everybody, or many people at the moment. And finally, where necessary, should be noticed, site visits will be starting from the middle of May, which should be now, and should be undertaken in line with the government's guidance on social distancing and safety requirements. There's also guidance, came last week, or updated guidance from PINS, in relation obviously to appeals. Some have commented that PINS' approach is more tentative than that of the government, as set out in Mr. Jenrick's written statement. And to be fair to PINS, they, and this is a subject of debate, as you will have seen from the press, but they do have to ensure that everyone is treated fairly and the system is robust and fair for all, as I say. Nonetheless, they have held the first fully digital hearing on the Monday the 11th of May, and that was held as a pilot, and they are hoping that at least a further 20 examinations, hearings and inquiries will follow during May and June. PINS then aim to scale up digital events to include high-profile and contentious cases in the following months. Just commend to you, before we move on from this, that the detailed guidance from PINS covers planning appeals, rights of way and Commons Act matters, nationally significant infrastructure events, and local plan examinations. And again, I commend that guidance to you, easily found, but again, if not, found on Chambers' website, Legal COVID-19 update of last Friday. So just turning to two other matters relating to appeals and planning applications. And firstly, the issue of community infrastructure levy, because concerns were raised by the development industry with regard to viability or outstanding requirements to pay the levy, wanting time to pay it. And in response to those concerns, the Ministry's update of the 13th of May says that the government will amend the Community Infrastructure Levy Regulations 2010 to enable charging authorities to defer payments, to temporarily disapply late payment interest, and to provide a discretion to return interest already charged where they consider it appropriate to do so. It should be noted, however, that the update says that the easements can be applied to developers with an annual turnover of less than £45 million. That's aimed at small and medium-sized firms, and not all, including the larger house builders or developers. It's also worth noting that it is intended these easements will not be open-ended, of course, and will be removed when the economic situation has recovered. As I record this, the amended legislation is, I believe, still awaited, and the amendments will be made to the regulations in due course, as the guidance tells us. It is, of course, to increase flexibility, but that will still depend upon charging authorities deciding to exercise the new discretion available to them. And the new instalment policies for defer payments will only apply to chargeable developments starting after the changes came into effect, but they are anticipated to apply to phases of the development starting after that date. And just worth noting that the announcement of the government added that, and I quote, existing flexibilities and the government's clear intention to legislate should give authorities confidence to see their to use their enforcement powers with discretion and provide some comfort to developers that, where appropriate, they will not be charged extra for matters that were outside of their control. And the final matter relating to applications is the Section 106 obligations, and local authorities are encouraged to consider the deferral of Section 106 obligations, and in particular, of course, the financial payments, given the implications of that, the difficulties that some will be facing. And this will require variations to existing such agreements and undertakings. And authorities are encouraged generally to take a pragmatic and proportionate approach to the enforcement of such obligations. Turning now to development plans, and Chambers is hoping to hold a webinar on development plans and current issues, both in relation to the COVID-19 ongoing crisis and other wider aspects. We're hoping to hold that in June. Keep an eye on the website if you're interested to see, just to check the date. It should be early June. But with regard to ongoing examinations, PINS is exploring the use of virtual methods to deal with them. They are currently working, we are told, with two local authorities to trial holding the local plan hearing sessions as digital events by video or telephone conference. And if the pilot is successful, the aim is to be able to offer this, where possible, for all current examinations. Of course, this is fairly critical if the government's aim of or aspiration to have all local plans in place by 2023 is not to be seriously held up and indeed not met at all. However, there is another very key part, and that relates to situation where preparation of the plan is ongoing prior to submission to the Secretary of State for examination under Regulation 19. And with regard to that consultation on emerging development plans, there's been very important new guidance issued last week, introducing new paragraphs 76 to 78 of the PPG. That arises from the fact the social distancing rules have caused difficulties for authorities wishing to consult on emerging plans, and particularly in respect of the requirements set out in their statements of community involvement, which have to be complied with in accordance with Section 19, subsection 3 of the 2004 Planning and Compulsory Purchase Act. As many of you will know, those statements include often requirements for physical events in terms of, for example, putting documents for consultation in local libraries as well as the council's main office. And indeed, under Regulation 35 of the Local Planning Regulations 2012, it is necessary to place them in that way in relation to the Regulation 19, and indeed any changes to the Statement of Community Involvement. But the guidance points out that temporary arrangements could be made to a Statement of Community Involvement where that is necessary to enable local planning authorities to use online engagement methods to their full potential, and local planning authorities are strongly encouraged so to do. Appropriate methods for doing that would include virtual exhibitions, digital consultations, video conferencing, social media, and providing documents for inspection, of course, on a public website. The guidance also points out that there is no statutory requirement for consultation when reviewing and updating the statements of community involvement. But it also makes it clear that fairness might require such consultation in some circumstances, and authorities are advised to consider that carefully. I should also just add that any of these changes do need to take into account the requirements of Regulation 35, and I'm not quite sure what the full implications of that might be, but that is something to be wary of. Turning specifically to neighbourhood plans, there's also new guidance on those, and that's found in paragraph 107 of the PPG, and that includes in relation to the referendum process, decision-making, oral representations for examinations and public consultation. This advice again encourages the use of virtual methods where necessary. It also points out that all neighbourhood planning referendums that have been recently cancelled or are scheduled to take place between the 16th of March 2020 and the 5th of May 2021 are postponed until the 6th of May 2021. And of course that's found under Regulation 12 of the Postponement of Elections and Referendums, Regulations 2020, which applies to England and Wales. And those prevent any neighbourhood planning referendum taking place until 6th of May next year. And the guidance also points out that more targeted methods of engagement with the community may be needed, and indeed care will be required in that respect to ensure that there has been fair and proper consultation. I turn then to the fourth of my fifth matters, which I'm briefly summarising, and that is compulsory purchase orders. The Ministry published again on Wednesday of last week the guidance relating to that, and in particular relating to service requirements, increasing time periods for people to respond to requests for information about an interest in the land being acquired, methods for returning compulsory purchase order documents and sending them back to acquiring authorities, and timing of vesting orders and compensation. And again, the link to that guidance, if required, found on our item of last Friday. And the final matter is in relation to nationally significant infrastructure projects. And the government is working with consenting departments to support the continuation of decision making in order to minimise the impact of current restrictions on the consideration of development consent order applications. And the Planning Inspectorate has updated its guidance accordingly. So I hope that quick run through of the events of last week is a helpful update for those who have perhaps haven't had as much time to read the planning press. Just before I finish, just a couple of matters, just try and lighten things a little. Quirk of the week. Going through some of the press last week myself, one thing did unusual struck me. It was actually in Knowledge Hub. I don't know whether you are familiar with Knowledge Hub, but those who work for or with local authorities may well come across it, but it's certainly worth a visit. They have some very interesting information, issues discussed on blogs and so on. But one thing I did notice was a situation where a planning authority had been told that the developer had needed to carry out a speed survey and to support an application, and they had put up signs in the relevant part of the highway saying, slow down please, tree cutting in operation, or words to that effect. Whereas in fact, it turned out that there were no trees being cut, and clearly it appears that the developer, quite extraordinarily, if it be the case, was simply seeking to slow down the traffic speeds so that they are presumably got a more favourable result that they could report to the authority. Not good, if I may say so, if it be correct. I've never come across myself anything quite like that before. So that's my planning quirk of the week. Many thanks for listening. If you found this useful, I may well do a further follow-up podcast, and I look forward to speaking to you then. Thank you very much. Keep safe and keep well in the meanwhile. Bye.